I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. New year, new name, new energy, but...
same old us.
And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. But that's not all. We will also have special guests to add their thoughts on the topics, as well as break down different political issues with local activists in their community. If you like to be informed and to expand your thoughts, listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
When your child fights sleep, it can feel like a battle you'll never win. Imagine a bedtime routine you all look forward to, where you cuddle in and let the stress of the day melt away. Welcome to Sleep Tight Stories, a calming weekly podcast that brings bedtime stories, cuddles, and comfort to families worldwide. The stories are quirky, relatable, and spark wonder without overstimulation, so listeners can fall asleep and stay asleep. Each episode is narrated by me, Cheryl McLeod, a second grade teacher, and written by my husband, Clark, an eternal second grader at heart. Tune in tonight and bond over a story before drifting off to sleep. Make bedtime the sweetest part of your day. Sleep Tight Stories. Listen to Sleep Tight Stories on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, this is Let's Talk About Myths, Baby, and I am your host, Liv, here with part two of the first ever two-part conversation episode, just because there was so much to say, and I learned so much, and I say that every time, but in this case, I learned two episodes worth, so it's really saying something. This is part two of my episode conversation with Kyle Lewis Jordan, all about Hephaestus. Hephaestus as a character, Hephaestus within and beyond the confines of Greek mythology, Hephaestus and his relationship with Athena, Hephaestus and reception of Greek myth in modern, so-called modern, you know, the last few hundred years sourcing, and then also popular culture of today. So much about Hephaestus, all also like in and around the realm of his impairment and disability within the Olympians and all of that. So fascinating. I'm just so thrilled that Kyle had the time to talk to me for this long, that we got so much into these episodes, that I now have this episode that came out on Tuesday all about Hephaestus as a character. You know, the things I had kind of missed in my mentions of him in the past, and now, you know, I'm able to see this whole new world. Anyway, now, one thing I realized after editing the episode with Kyle is that I didn't ask him to share where you all can and should follow him on the internet. So I would highly recommend that you follow Kyle on Twitter, where his handle is the very Egyptian, at Horus of Nekhen. That's HorusOfNekhen. Where he says you can follow him for all sorts of other exciting disability in antiquity and Egyptology related content. Also, I have put two links in the description of this episode where you can watch a couple of the talks that he has done on disability in Egyptian mythology and just Egyptology in general. There really is so much to learn, and there are such cool people doing the work on it. This is so much fun for me, such a thrill. I can't wait for you to hear the rest of this episode. And so, without any further ado... Conversations. Sing, muses of Hephaestus, famed for inventions. With Kyle Lewis Jordan, Part 2.
In terms of his relationships with his other kin, I think actually his relationship with Athena is probably the most interesting. Because mm-hmm. the two are essentially, in a manner of speaking, the two are inseparable. If one is doing something, the other is often not too far behind in some way mm-hmm. or fashion. The two work together quite a lot, from what I've read, at least, or from what I've seen. And obviously the two's cults in the actual physical world are very closely entwined. Obviously at Athens you have the Acropolis and you have Athena's temple, but not too far away from that you have the temple of Hephaestus as well. Mm-hmm. And there is actually I don't know what the right word is, because obviously the gods, depending on location, had different epithets, but mm-hmm, there is one epithet mm-hmm. of Athena, which is Athena Hephaestia, I think is basically the partnership of the two. Not in any way, obviously, a romantic one, but because she is the cunning kind of goddess of industry, and he is obviously the craftsman. So the two go hand in hand, and obviously their relationship in terms of, as far as the myths go, again, if we go back and we accept the variation of the myth where Hephaestus conked Zeus on the head and out came mm-hmm. Athena,
which is one of my favorites.
Yeah, I think it's just the image in my head, like I said earlier, I just love it. But yeah, the idea of obviously Athena springs forth and there they are, and again on the Parthenon frieze, like I mentioned earlier, where he has his crutch, who's he speaking to? He's speaking mm-hmm. to Athena, because the two just seem to have this like near constant relationship because of how close their natures are. And I think obviously for Athena that is just its complement to her kind of wider thinking kind of scope, that she can obviously see that this is a relationship that's beneficial to her, especially.
Mm-hmm. Complete connection there. He's the craftsman god, and she is a god of like the womanly crafts, mm. which is her only sort of explicitly feminine attribute mm-hmm. to an otherwise fairly, you know, genderless god, as mm-hmm. Julie Levy pointed out. Yeah, that you know, other than you know, her being Athena being this goddess of womanly crafts, and then her, you know, so-called birth, and this we will get into that with Hephaestus, of the Athenian people, mm-hmm. you know, she's otherwise fairly genderless, but they are have an explicit connection there by mm-hmm. both being these like two sides of craftsmanship and of mm-hmm. creation, which I think is kind of fascinating there. Yeah,
no, absolutely. And I think obviously the two have, she has gained a lot from obviously his craft. He made her fleece, obviously, is one of the big things that comes up. One that even Zeus borrows on occasion, which I just find hilarious. Just this idea of, oh, this looks good, I'll take that. And you know, the two work together there. They also help Heracles in mm-hmm. his labors. It's the mm-hmm. sixth labor, the birds, the kind of harpies.
Oh, the Stymphalian birds.
Stymphalian birds. Yeah, they work together to basically help him do that, which is just a cool little tale, I think. Yeah, and there's just so much you can take away from it, especially because obviously, as you mentioned, what often gets focused on is his attempted rape mm-hmm. essentially of Athena, and how she basically is like, not having none of that.
Yeah,
and basically dispatches him quite handily, and he quickly scurries away.
Just to connect, because I think this is important, yeah. as much as it is, you know, it's a bad, it is an attempted rape, but in her
dispatching him, just like kind of tossing him to the side, he ejaculates on the ground.
Yes,
and thus are born the Athenian people, which connects them both to Hephaestus and to Athena, which I think is makes that deeper connection of like, and the, you know, the Athenians wouldn't have, they, I don't think that it was, you know, and maybe it was different because it's Hephaestus, but, you know, obviously their connection to assault was very different. They did understand assault, but I think in that case, it wasn't seen as anything traumatic. It was more of that, like, Athena is, you know, not a god who has sex, but in order for the two to make the Athenian people, that is how it had to happen.
Yeah.
And so I think they saw it more as that kind of, it was kind of like, yeah, you know, a parentage without them having to have sex, because that would have fucked with their idea of Athena, which I think is quite interesting. And it also takes a little bit of the onus off of Hephaestus, as much as we don't want to from a modern perspective.
Yeah.
But when it comes to them, it was that major connection of you know, he also was a sort of unofficial parent to the Athenians, which is important.
It is important. And I think also, obviously, there is worth bearing in mind that the Olympians are, of course, not human. They have a very different relationship with trauma. And so in Athena's case, I think the reason that she just kind of essentially, like you said, she throws him off, the Athenians are born. And at that point, I think she's more interested in them than what happened, because she's
exactly
just like,
yeah, it's not a big deal to her at all. Yeah.
I think that is also partly because, like you said, they share this bond in both being craftsmen gods. And in that way, she is far too cunning to dispatch of the fact that the two actually work quite well together. So in her mind, I don't think she would see it as beneficial to just to kind of relegate him all of a sudden, especially because fundamentally, from an Olympian point of view, you guys are going to be together for essentially eternity. There's no point in holding a grudge. But of course, that is important to bear in mind. That is why that happens, because they are Olympians. So that's obviously there are no human takeaways there. That's not like, you know, I would not expect anyone else to react the same way. But that is just the nature of the thing. And it's always worth bearing in mind. But yeah, I think what I would always be interested in, going back to this modern retelling, I would be far more interested in seeing a modern exploration of their relationship, I think. And I think, for one, I would still include that origin story of the Athenians. I would not want to get rid of that. I think it's important that it stays that way. And I think you could explore that relationship, because I do think it is fair to say that is in some way an unrequited love, because he is very much enamored with her.
They would make a good couple. Like, I can, you know, if Athena were of the type to want to be in a couple, like, I mean, certainly I think those two would have been ideal. So I can see.
It does have a kind of feeling to it, doesn't it? I do think the two have a bond of a kind. I just don't think it's obviously a romantic one, because again, that just doesn't fit for Athena. Not really. Mm-hmm. At least not in the kind of the way that we think of, say, Ares and Aphrodite. It would in no way be the same. I think the two find their bond through their craft. And I like to think of, I would love to see a story where, like, Athena just brings him metals to work, like, you know, just literally leaves him metals, and he just like, oh yay, more metal, and you know, he goes and makes another automaton or something, and she's just like, oh, that's nice. Or, you know, the two team up to beat up a giant or something, I don't know, like, just anything. There is so much to that relationship that you could explore, and it's also a very interesting way in which you could explore this modern ideas about relationships and be his nature as a disabled god. I think that more so than his marriage with Aphrodite, because that is so complicated and multi-layered in a way that it would be difficult, I think, to do either side justice.
Agreed, yeah.
Because of course, like I said earlier, I don't think I don't judge Aphrodite in like saying, oh, how dare she do that? Because again, this was not a marriage that she consented to, and she's the goddess of love and all the rest of it. But again, it makes it complicated on the other side, because again, of the lack of agency and all the rest of it. But I think with Athena and Hephaestus, you have a much more equal partnership, which could very much explore that idea of like them kind of exploring those boundaries together. And eventually, in the aftermath of the Athenians being born, the two of them just saying like, all right, look, we have children now, I guess. I guess we have a responsibility to uphold. And so the two of them just kind of agree, this is just how we are going to be kind of work together from now on. And I think that could be done in a way where both of them kind of walk away kind of happy with the circumstances, as happy as Olympians can be, I guess. But I do think it would be a very interesting story to tell with a modern lens. I think there are so many layers of that you can unpick. And it also, fundamentally, it would be a great way to, again, dispel this Quasimodoing of Hephaestus. You could actually show him as this, again, equal partner. He's not... I would hate to see, this is another reason why I would never want to see much picking apart of Aphrodite and Hephaestus, because that's far too easy to do Beauty and the Beast, which is just one thing.
Oh, that's so true.
Yeah, which disability in myth, but also folklore, far too often gets connotated with beastliness. I mean,
yeah,
even
monstrosity.
In, monstrosity. Even in the Greek myth, for instance, one other aspect of Hephaestus' nature that we didn't address earlier is that he sweats. And he's the only god that's really described as sweating, apart from, funnily enough, his mother. Hera gets described as sweating once in the Iliad. I think it's when it's around the time where the gods decide to get involved, like full on, and she's starting to mess with Troy. I think she sweats under the labor of what she's doing. I can't remember what. I'm sorry. It's been a very long time since I've read it in full.
I mean, I didn't even know that we had that. That's fascinating, that connection.
Yeah, but he sweats like an animal, which is just not in any other way that you would ever see an Olympian described. In the same way, like you think of satyrs, for instance, how they are most often kind of illustrated and imagined as essentially people with dwarfism, and how they are just intimately connected with the animal kingdom and this kind of bestial nature. They're not really human, which... is very different from, say, the Near East, where people with dwarfism are roundabout, especially in Egypt's case, very highly regarded. I mean, people often like to point out Bes, the dwarf god of protection in the household, but it's worth bearing in mind that Bes doesn't really appear until much later in terms of Egyptian time span, like end of the Middle Kingdom, start of the New Kingdom. So even in the Old Kingdom, like going, well, even further than that, the pre-dynastic, you have people with dwarfism appearing in the Pharaonic court, which is something that I study.
Interesting.
And things like that. So bodily difference in other parts of the world is taken very differently. But in Greece, especially things like dwarfism, but also gigantism, which is obviously an opposite, they just get kind of imbued with all this kind of bestial nature, which is interesting. So again, kind of going off on a tangent there, sorry.
No, it's fascinating. I've never made that connection. To me, there's so many creatures that are so fantastical that I've never thought to make that connection. So I think it is really fascinating, because to me, it's always satyrs. I've always connected satyrs with like centaurs, you know, just completely fictional, fantastical characters, and therefore like unhuman, but not in any kind of way like that. That's really interesting, and certainly makes sense to that sort of the connection, and therefore like the comparison to Egypt is quite interesting.
That's again why I would kind of be apprehensive of doing an Aphrodite Hephaestus story, at least to start with. I think it could be done, but it would take a lot of unpacking, and I think an easier start would be looking at his relationship with Athena instead, especially because I think from Athena's point of view, she looks at him as far more than an equal than I think most of his peers do, with the exception of a few. He does have good relationships with, again, like I said, Prometheus is one. Helios is another. Actually, in the story, of Aphrodite and Ares, it is Helios who kind of alerts him to the realities of that. I actually,
and then spies for him later. Yeah,
and spies for him later.
Connection. Yeah,
that's again because everyone is in this odd way. They are indebted to Hephaestus. Because of the things that he makes for them. Obviously, Hermes and his sandals, Athena and his fleece, Helios and his chariot. Like, there's so much that they owe him. And so they are wary of that. They are mindful of this debt that they have. But obviously, some kind of navigate it in a slightly different way to others. But in cases of, like, Helios and Athena as well, I think Athena takes it as a sign of friendship in a way, I think. And again, just because of their natures. And so I think you could tell a very equal kind of story, and you could explore their natures respectively through that, and could really do it justice, I think, in a way that I really think disabled representations in myth and folklore deserve to be told, because far too often it is, again, linked with this kind of monstrosity and things. And that's kind of always what errs me on the side of caution whenever people do have this kind of overly negative reaction to Hephaestus. I can completely understand it. Again, don't get me wrong, but it's like, it does worry me because, I mean, again, I am a disabled man and I've been in positions where people do have these sort of reactions to me for odd reasons. And it's just, it puts you in a very uncomfortable position. And I think a lot of disabled people who are interested in the ancient and classical world and they look at figures like Hephaestus, they do feel a certain kind of understanding with the god, because he is someone, at least from our modern perceptions of him, who you know, we can appreciate that frustration, that anger, even if he kind of obviously takes it to an extreme that, you know, even I would be like, all right, dude, calm the fuck down.
Yeah. Maybe a bit much.
Yeah, like, there's no need for slut shaming now.
Yeah,
like, it's just, if anyone who is listening who likes to do these modern retellings, because I've seen, because I saw you tweet a while back and you had these, you were asking people about art, who did art, and I saw this lovely comic, I can't remember the name, I am so sorry if they're listening, but someone posted this lovely comic and that actually showed Hephaestus, and it was like, so my name's Hephaestus and this is my wife Aphrodite and her boyfriend Ares, and that was interesting. It was pretty cool because he was in a wheelchair too. He looked pretty neat. Although, and this is not a criticism of the artist, just to be clear, it did strike me that that Hephaestus was depicted as kind of orcish, I guess I would describe him, character. And I have no doubt that the artist had no ill intentions in that regard. But again, it is telling that disability is often paired with monstrosity, even if it's intended not to be ill. It often happens that way. So I would like to see a presentation of Hephaestus that doesn't do that, that tries to show that he is literally an Olympian by all accounts, except in the way that he is treated. And by that nature, that is how he is disabled. And again, I think you could explore that through his partnership with Athena and therefore by proxy the other gods by comparison.
I have so many incredible thoughts based on all of this. So for one, I think, so just thinking about Hephaestus in this way and his relationship with Aphrodite, you know, based on kind of everything you've brought up and just sort of, you know, not absolving him at all, but just looking at it from this different lens. I think something that that I've personally overlooked, and again, I'll admit to fully, you know, not ever giving Hephaestus his due, but I think that you can see his marriage to Aphrodite as not only being non-consensual on her part, but on his as well. Because while I think the assumption and the, like, the way we're sort of conditioned to think about it is that, like, obviously he would want to marry her because she's this beautiful goddess of love and beauty, but ultimately their marriage comes about via, you know, his entrapping Hera in this golden throne. So, you know, to the reminder about it, he entraps Hera in this golden throne. They're all trying to free her, and you know, Zeus basically promises marriage to Aphrodite to whoever can free Hera. And Ares fails and thus doesn't marry her. And then, I forget who it is, it's probably Poseidon because he's such a gross god. I think it's Poseidon who goes to Hephaestus and is like, hey, you know, if you just let Hera go, you know, you can marry Aphrodite. And so I think because of that, it's sort of taken as if Hephaestus is like, oh yeah, hell yeah, you know, I'll marry this woman against her will just by freeing this person that I entrapped in the first place. But I think if you ultimately turn it around and look at it, that Hephaestus's role with the Olympians and his, you know, his treatment was such that he was coerced or felt like he had to free Hera and thus was ultimately forced to marry Aphrodite. Like, not necessarily that he was like, oh yeah, you'll do it because I get to marry Aphrodite, but as if he freed her, you know, either because he changed his mind or because he was convinced or because they held it against him and he knew that his life would be easier if he did, but ultimately was led to marry Aphrodite even though she didn't love him. And then you have all of these things, because I also think, and this, you know, is not super important, but I think it's a side note that adds to everything, is that my standpoint is that Aphrodite and Ares are the only representations of actual love amongst the Olympians, romantic love. I don't see another example of that is like a mutual ultimate romantic love with gods like that. And so I think that, you know, Hephaestus getting stuck with Aphrodite is equally bad for him. Like, you know, he would, I'm sure, would love a wife who loves him. But here he's forced to marry this woman who doesn't love him at all. He doesn't love her. Like, so many things can be read into that. But I think ultimately they are, you know, based on both his disability and the patriarchy, it's assumed that he would just want to marry Aphrodite because she's gorgeous, you know, this like, well, she's a beautiful woman, so obviously he wants her. Like that level of, you know, it says a lot about women and people with disability, this connection with like the way that, you know, ultimately everything was determined by these like, you know, able-bodied men, you know? And so I think that's quite interesting to look at it that way as well. And it doesn't take, you know, it doesn't absolve him of what he does, but it does make it a little bit more, you can see a little bit more where he's coming from.
Yeah.
And it makes it a little bit, like the anger, I think, more comes from, you know, his situation versus like this kind of inherent, and not situation based on his disability, but based on his like life with Aphrodite that would probably suck, right?
Yeah.
Like, and so I think it's just an interesting like extra level to look at it when it comes to him.
Absolutely. I like a lot of what you said. And I think from my retelling, it's Dionysus who goes down.
Oh,
and
you're
like,
right.
Yeah,
it's Dionysus.
It's Dionysus because he gets him drunk and he brings him back up on an ass, which is also another aspect to the story. If you did want to take that idea that he is technically forced into this marriage as well, he is imbued. He is drunk. He is not consensual in this regard. He is like, he has literally been coerced into accepting this marriage. So you could take it that way as well. The way I always remembered the story was that actually he kind of freed Hera, and then he was kind of like, and now you're married to Aphrodite, to which I think he's like, what? Like, because remember what he's asking for when he does that. He just wants to be accepted as an Olympian on his own terms. That's what he's asking for.
And by his mother.
And
like,
by his mother.
Like a motherly acceptance and Olympian acceptance.
And what he gets is like not what he wants. And it's the same story with what happens with Aphrodite, Ares, and him. He goes expecting his dowry back, and he doesn't even get that. He gets Poseidon offering to pay the dowry, which is not the same thing.
It's not the same,
It's not the... I mean, remember, these are gods. He doesn't care about financial implications. That's irrelevant to him, especially as a crafting god. He can make whatever he pleases.
Yeah.
It's for him, I think, it's the acceptance of who he is and what he is, and that he is as deserving of the status of his kin than anything else. But he's denied that again and again and again. And that is what I think torments him, and therefore subsequently makes him this very, very angry and sometimes very violent kind of god. And again, that does not absolve him of the nasty things that he does. You know, I'm not saying that he was right to do what he did to Aphrodite or anything like that. But it does show, again, it goes back to what I said a lot earlier. It shows the desperation that he felt that was what he felt he had to do, in the same way that he felt he had to buy his way into Olympus by effectively threatening them and being like, you know, let me in or else. And it's that just defines their relationship. And I think with Aphrodite and Hephaestus, this kind of comes back to what I was saying at the very beginning when I mentioned how in modern interpretations he does get Quasimodo. And I do think this is sometimes paralleled reflected upon his relationship with Aphrodite. The idea of Quasimodo, it actually comes from, I saw this image recently. I can't tell you where it was from. I'm not sure of the exact kind of context, but it was an image that supposedly shows Hephaestus and Aphrodite, and what it shows is Hephaestus has his clubbed foot, but he also has a hunchback. He also has this disfigured face, and he has all these like wonderful gifts in his arms, and he's essentially chasing. It looks like he's chasing like Aphrodite, who's running from him, and is like, you know, oh, get away from me! I don't want those gifts. And that, like, I did have this conversation once with someone, and they were saying, you know, oh, you know, to me, Aphrodite and Hephaestus is a case of unrequited love. And I understand why, because from some retellings, that's obviously how it might come across. But to me, I kind of can't agree with that, because like that always just, like, I mean, maybe always is an exaggeration, but by far and away, too often when a disabled person wants to get into a relationship, far too often the public perception is, oh, it's always going to be unrequited love, because the underlying assumption is who would ever love a disabled person? And I mean, you get this today with very happy couples who, you know, one partner may be disabled, and you hear these stories of people who approach them and, you know, approach the especially if it's a female partner who's non-disabled. It seems to be. If a female partner, you know, is in a relationship with a disabled man, it seems to, but I'm sure there are observations of the reverse, just to be clear. Mm-hmm. But it mm-hmm. does seem to happen a lot the other way around. They'll go up to them and they'll say, you know, oh, I'm so sorry. It's like, sorry for what? Like, yeah. You know, it's like all these things. Like with Hephaestus and Aphrodite, I think that modern perception, that very recent modern perception, has been implanted on that. And I think more so in reality, I think that both of them are just fed up being in the situation.
Yeah. I think that's absolutely right.
Neither of them are kind of happy. And so therefore, mm-hmm. in a way, I would think perhaps his reaction, Hephaestus's reaction to the cuckolding, is less so that he's annoyed with, he's like shocked that Aphrodite has mm-hmm. done this. Mm-hmm. He's just more annoyed by the fact that why on earth are we stuck in this if clearly I don't love her and she doesn't love me. She clearly wants to be with Ares. Can we just be done with it? And like, obviously this is my interpretation and my imagination at this point, but I like to imagine that this has been going on for a while. Hephaestus knows about it. Hephaestus actually doesn't care too much because, again, mm-hmm. he's also in relationships with her charities. So, you know, the mm-hmm. feeling's mutual. But but he's probably gone to Zeus multiple times and said, you know, look, I'm not in love with your daughter. I don't want her. Can I have my dowry back? Mm-hmm. And Zeus has just been like, no. Like, no, mm-hmm. you can't. And he's just been like, oh, I'm fed up with this. And so that's eventually the extreme that he goes to. And again, that doesn't make it right at all. It makes it makes it terrible. And I'm sure, mm-hmm. obviously, when Aphrodite flees away out of shame, at least mm-hmm. how that's translated, mm-hmm. and she goes into hiding for a while. Obviously, we never see the aftermath of these things, too. Mm-hmm. That's important to bear in mind. The story just kind mm-hmm. of ends. You could imagine either probably Hephaestus might have felt incredibly guilty afterwards. He might have been like, oh, God, I just kind of exploded like a volcano and caused all this destruction and look mm-hmm. at what I did. But we don't know. You could interpret it in many different ways. But I think the way I would kind of want people to look at their relationship isn't this sort of unrequited love where it's mm-hmm. kind of like, oh, of course she would never love Hephaestus. It's not that I don't think she would ever love Hephaestus. They were just never, that relationship was never allowed to form of its own accord. It just kind of got put together. And that's why I think it never worked, because, you know, love just doesn't happen that way. So I would just ask people not to look at it that like that, because it then does lead to this insinuation that that's just how relationships with disabled people go, which is just really difficult to say as a disabled person how that often does affect your relationships. Like, I mean, I don't want to get all soporific, and you're more than welcome to cut this out. Speaking as a disabled man, the amount of times that, you know, even the suggestion that I would be in a partnership with a certain person, and that person, by no ill will of their own, will just have a sudden very violent quote-unquote reaction because the entire thought of it, but then they'll realize and they'll come and apologize and they're like, I'm sorry I reacted in that way, I don't know why I did. But it's so ingrained that people mm-hmm. do just have this visceral reaction to the idea, and it's just, you know, I really wish we did start to just tell stories a little differently. It's mm-hmm. okay to have a relationship that doesn't work out, and mm-hmm. that can include disabled people, but it don't bring it down to their disability or their embodiment, because again, in reality, I don't think it had anything to do with that. I think it just had to do with the fact that the two, by their very natures, were very different creatures, effectively, and would never have loved each other anyway, at least not in that way.
No, I think that's completely important, and I think true. Like, I mean, from a textual standpoint of the sources, and I've read a lot of them, I don't think it's unrequited at all. I think it's 100% just like, he's mad at the situation. You know, it's not a good situation. It makes him look bad, and, you know, whatever you want to say about that, but that's more to do with the way it's written and who tells the stories again. But I don't think it's meant to suggest that he's like obsessively in love with her and she doesn't love him back. And I do think, yeah, that comes in later as these interpretations of it, but in the sourcing, it really isn't there. You mm. know, he marries her because of the situation with Hera and because of Zeus. There also is some sourcing, I believe, though I can't think of what it would be necessarily, that suggests that their marriage comes about more directly through the machinations of Zeus, and just him wanting Aphrodite, like, quote unquote, off the market with a man like Hephaestus, which I think is, you know, that's again is the suggestion of, you know, taking, you know, the effects on his him as a person and his agency completely, and it is more suggestive of, you know, just how shitty Zeus is, as we all know. But I also think, you know, and connecting to that, like, we get this idea that Hephaestus is angry, that he does all these things to Aphrodite. And again, like, they are bad, but they are based on who's telling the stories and the stories. And yet we never get a judgment on what Zeus does, you know? And it's so interesting that, because Zeus does a million things worse than Hephaestus. Like, so many more things that are worse. And so, yeah, this idea that there is this judgment involved with Hephaestus is interesting. And obviously, you know, like, probably based in his disability.
Again, we have to look at his relationships in the broader context of what the other Olympians are doing, and obviously Zeus has his own motives, as he always does. You can't look at any of the gods without considering their relationship with the others. The Olympians are a total package. You gotta take the whole subscription or none at all, I think.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. New year, new name, new energy, but...
same old us.
And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. But that's not all. We will also have special guests to add their thoughts on the topics, as well as break down different political issues with local activists in their community. If you like to be informed and to expand your thoughts, listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Parents, ready to discover a new educational and interactive podcast for kids? Join Stories for Kids by Lingo Kids, where episodes are packed with fun activities. Right, Elliot?
Oh, yes! We learned how to recycle at the beach.
That was great fun. Callie, what do you say?
It was. And that time when we did the science experiment and Billy made Raisin's dance.
That is so cool, Billy.
He did. Not to mention when a certain Elliot took up swimming classes with Lisa.
That was me.
Bet you can't catch me.
I'm going to get you.
All this fun and more in our Stories for Kids. Lingo Kids Stories for Kids is now available on StoryButton, the kid-friendly device for screenless podcast listening. Listen to Stories for Kids on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Reflecting back on what I said about the kind of association with beastliness and this sort of thing, because beasts, obviously, in particular, animals that sweat. So you're thinking of asses, of horses, of things, pack animals, basically. Mm. Pack animals, often associated as well with slaves taken from war. Hephaestus, obviously, I think it would be a stretch to say that he is in any way associated with slaves. That would be far too much of a kind of stretch. But I would say it is an interesting kind of thing to think about how he labors away in the forge to do all these things for the Olympians, in the same way that these are societies that that extract great amounts of labor from bodies of people that they have conquered or stolen or bought from elsewhere in the world. And that often gets erased whenever we think about their stories or their cultures or their achievements. You know, you must critically, if you ever want to study the classical world, you must consider slavery in every aspect. You really must, because it is foundational to everything that they did. And in that sense, when you think of labors, whenever you see labor discussed or talked about, you're not thinking of workmen as we do today. You're thinking of slaves. And in that way, you know, Hephaestus sweating and toiling away, huffing and puffing like he does in the beginning of the Iliad when he's toing and froing with the drinks. You know, it's never explicitly stated. And again, I think it would be far too much of a stretch to say he's treated like a slave. He's nowhere close to that. But it is interesting to look at the conflation between the disabled body and slavery, because that slavery by its very nature is a very violent act, does disable. Disability is not just something that you are born with. It is something that you often are transformed into. It's the body is malleable. It changes, and it can change under a lot of stress and a lot of trauma. And slavery is key to that. And especially for the Romans, I can say, the Greeks less so, but the Romans had this odd fascination with disabled slaves. They you know, you have market advertisements asking for deaf or even, I think deaf slaves were quite popular because, of course, they can't hear you. So, they won't basically be bought out to spy on you or what have you. I don't know. There's stuff like that. So, but also, like, they loved having slaves with any sort of physical sort of difference to them, because these people are collectible. So again, this is something else to bear in mind when you're looking at disability in the ancient world, especially Greece and Rome, is this association with things, and that again ties in with that beastliness. And I think, while again Hephaestus, I wouldn't call him a slave by any means, his labors and the toll that takes on him are something worth bearing in mind when we think about embodiments and how that manifests and how he manages that, because he clearly has the capacity to manage it. He makes these automatons and all these things to aid him. If he's allowed to use them, that makes his job hell of a lot easier. But when the Olympians deny him that, it obviously makes it 10 times worse. Fundamentally, what my overall taking away point from this is not just about Hephaestus. It's that if you can see it on this mythological level, if it exists on this kind of theological level, or whatever you want to call it, then clearly it goes deeper than that. If these gods are a reflection of the inner natures of humanity to what extent or another, then I think as well the decision to have him embody this says something more than I think it's ever been given credit for until maybe very recently. So again, just bear that in mind. His relationship with sweating, his relationship with anger, all these things, and his relationship with the other Olympians, and how that's supposed to model in certain respects this kind of ideal of how society should exist, or at least how elite society should exist, because that's the other thing to bear in mind again, how these stories were produced, for whom and by whom. And that's the other thing. We don't see the variations that would have been had amongst everyday Greek people or everyday Roman people, where attitudes would have been fairly different, for sure. But we just never know, and we will never know. But we do have ourselves to reflect on and to interpret these stories. So all those interpretations we discussed about Aphrodite and Hephaestus, or Athena and Hephaestus, you know, people are like, oh, but they're straying from the original myth. It's like, well, actually, you know, I don't think there ever was really an original myth. A lot of these myths started from oral traditions, which just manifested and changed in very different ways. And that's just the nature of humans. We are a storytelling creature by nature. So yeah, it's just, again, so basically, I hope this discussion about Hephaestus and his very complex nature gets you to reflect on how much deeper, the further you go, how much it permeates throughout these societies. Because it isn't just there by accident. It isn't just there for aesthetic. It's much deeper than that. for the benefit of your viewers, if you do put this bit in,
mm-hmm.
I gave a talk very recently at the Allard Pearson, which is the university collection of the museum collection of the University of Amsterdam. We were looking at disability in antiquity, and I gave a talk on an 18th century BCE Egyptian woman called Geheset, which means gazelle, and she is the earliest known case of a woman with cerebral palsy in the ancient world. Cerebral palsy is the condition that I have. So I spoke about her and tried to kind of, as a disabled scholar, give the sense of not looking at disabled people in the ancient world as just embodying their disability alone, or as if everything happens either because of or in spite of their disability. Mm-hmm. It is everything else that goes along with that, that pairs along with that, that gives you a sense of what the reality was. And again, it's not a black and white thing. And I think, again, the same is true for Hephaestus in the mythological sense. Mm-hmm. I hope what this chat has discovered, either across one episode or two, however it gets cut, is that it is very multifaceted, and it does play a role. It is significant. I don't think you should erase mm-hmm. it, but also it isn't the only thing that's going on here. There's much more going on, mm-hmm. and this is true of almost every facet. The ancient world is no less complex than the modern one, because often mm-hmm. I'm going off on a completely different tangent in terms of how we think about
story of everything. This is my podcast.
Yeah, it's far too often, because we want to obviously distance ourselves from the ancient world just because of span of time and everything else, we want mm-hmm. to make ourselves obviously look forward and progressive and different in thought, when actually, like we said earlier, the ancient Greeks had a concept of violence against women. They knew what rape was. They knew what these things were. Obviously, it is not incorrect to say that women were unfortunately very, very much oppressed in those situations, but that does not mean that they themselves were not conscious of that and did not think about that. We kind of make the past look dead, like it's static, like it didn't have emotion mm-hmm. of its own, like it didn't have conscious thought of its own. And obviously that's partly because we can never hope to embody it fully, but that doesn't mean that we shouldn't try. In that case, obviously, from the example of speaking about disability in the ancient world, like I can only hope that by being a disabled scholar, I can help at least open some doors to at least understand what it's like to live in a disabled body. I can never speak to anyone's embodiment in the ancient world fully, because obviously there are just some things we will never really truly know, but it doesn't mean we shouldn't try. And if we accept mm-hmm. as well that obviously we are always going to be coming in with a modern reception in mind, then we understand that as well. Often, too often in disability and antiquity studies, scholars will say, oh, the concept of disability did not exist because there wasn't an overarching word, or there wasn't I don't need a word to tell me what my life is like, what that embodiment feels like. I agree that there is no structure to disability in the same way that there is a political structure today with the politics of disablement, with the social model like we discussed a lot earlier. Mm-hmm. But that does not mean that disability did not exist. That's far too sweeping a statement. Of course it existed.
Mm-hmm.
Of course it existed. It's always existed, and it will always exist. And it just changes. The nature of it changes, both in terms of its embodiment, but also in terms of how our relationships go with other people. In mm-hmm. some ways, I don't think you could ever say that Greece was wholly positive or wholly negative towards it, in the same way that I don't mm-hmm. think you could say any society ever has been or will be. It is mm-hmm. just the way things are. Humans are complicated like that. You know, far too often, you know, people try and find those absolute answers, and there really never is one. And I think if we just mm-hmm. accepted that, we might be a little bit more, not only a bit more content with that reality, but also open up our minds to being able to see how much more complicated and multifaceted the ancient world was, just like it is today.
Completely true. Yeah, it's interesting to me how much that connects with so many of the things I talk about, but so explicitly, like, you know, I don't want to lessen anything, so, you mm-hmm. know, and please be perfectly honest with me if what I say does at all, because I think this is a really important topic. But I think that just looking at it the way that, like, people treat women mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. like, assault and things, it's so similar in the way that people like to think that because women, you know, were, or they, certainly women were property and all of this, but that because, you know, all the gods were, you know, assaulting all the time, that somehow that meant it wasn't bad. Or, you know, the thing that comes up for me so often is that, like, well, given Hesiod as our oldest source for so many things, like, if Hesiod didn't say it was assault, then it clearly wasn't assault. And I'm like, that's so fucking wild. And also, betrays a complete lack of understanding of Hesiod as a person, because he has made his views on women very clear and thus would have never cared to say whether or not it was assault. And that doesn't mean that we can't obviously look at something and you know, say that objectively it probably was. And so it's just so interesting the way that the connection is made to, you know, negating that these things ever even were a thing back then, in the same way that you're saying, you know, this idea that disability wasn't a concept back then. It's like, just because that we have changed the way we have understood these things and have better terminology and you know, ways of verbalizing what we're talking about and understanding and all of these things, it doesn't mean that it wasn't just as, you know, important and like and valid back then. It's just that everything, you know, the way we understand these things changes based on the world around us. And so, yeah, I mean, I think it's such an interesting way to, I just think it's so relevant to everything I talk about in my podcast. So many connections to be made there in terms of the way that we view these things, the way that pop culture views mythology and the disabled people in mythology. But so, you know, obviously the connection is so explicit to Hephaestus and the way that, I mean, this connects to the last thing that I had that I wanted to get your thoughts on and also bring up is, you know, we were talking about reception earlier of pop culture reception and, you know, lack of, or the way that Hephaestus is turned into this like monstrosity, you know, this like almost inhuman looking person in a way that the Olympians are so very human in their appearances. And so two depictions of Hephaestus come to mind and very different. And so I wanted to know whether you've seen them and also your thoughts. So first, have you ever, a lot of people don't know that Disney's Hercules, they made a TV show after.
I did know that there was one, but I haven't seen it because I don't think it was really aired in the UK.
Fair. Yeah, I feel like it definitely like is not a thing that most people know of. I happen to be the perfect age to have watched it and also in Canada, okay. So it was ideal. But I'm going to send you a picture of a bunch of the gods. Yep. Yes. And I find this, I mean, you know, it's very 1990s, but I find it so fascinating. So Hephaestus in Disney's Hercules, the TV show, I don't think he's in the movie.
No, I don't think he ever appears. From what I remember.
Yeah. So he's this like big, buff, clearly meant to be very good looking man working at his forge in a lot of episodes. And he's incredibly, you know, very jacked, like strong man. And I don't think that he is depicted as having any sort of visible disability, whether they meant to like fully erase it or not. I mean, certainly if that was the case, it's not ideal. And then Ares is this like, basically he's like the polar opposite of Hephaestus in a way that you don't expect based on knowledge of the myths and past representations, I would say. And I think that's partially because they have Aphrodite very happily, you know, with Hephaestus and not with Ares. But I think it's very interesting, that decision, because it's very counter to what you see a lot of Hephaestus. And then there's also, and sort of the complete, I would say, like near opposite of that is, have you seen the very recent depiction of Hephaestus in Lore Olympus, the webtoon?
I have only just started reading Lore Olympus, and I haven't got anywhere near Hephaestus's appearance yet, and I was hoping that he would appear, so I'm glad to hear that he does.
Are you comfortable with a spoiler?
Go ahead. It's probably going to be a long time before I get there anyway, so please.
He only came in the last few months.
Yeah. Oh, hello. That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's the blade. That's actually pretty cool.
Yeah. So to describe him, so Hephaestus in Lore Olympus, it has, I don't know the, like, it's prosthetic legs, but it's not. It's, what is their word for
they're
it?
Running, you know? They're running blades. That's not the official term for them, but they are like, if you've ever watched the Paralympics, they are running blades. So yeah.
Yeah, so he has those, and he has a golden arm, or like bronze or something. And he, in the actual, like, you know, story, he doesn't want anything to do with the Olympians. They like need something from him, and he's kind of like, okay. And he's very like quiet and calm and staid, and just sort of, he's just like this brilliant man who kind of like works. I think he has like some people with him, so he's not alone, but he's also not connected with the drama of Lore Olympus. And I loved it. Like, I, you know, Rachel Smythe and I are like, we're Twitter mutuals. We have DMs.
Yeah.
Now and then. And I I messaged her immediately and I was like, oh my God, I like just love this depiction of Hephaestus. I think it does so much for the character and so much for representation and like she just handled it beautifully well. And I think, you know, I think it was the perfect way of not remotely erasing his disability and instead making it like his kind of strength and making him like she completely took away his anger, took away there's no real relationship with, I think is clear from the rest of the comic, that there's no relationship with Aphrodite. He's just like on his own. And I think she just basically turned Hephaestus into like a real person in a way that he is often not, you know, he's not defined by his bad relationships with others. He's not defined by his anger. He's just defined by his skills in craftsmanship and his just like his overall talents. And I think that that's fascinating. I loved it.
Oh, well. But yeah, I mean, those two right there are both really interesting for different reasons. First, with the Disney Hercules one, I think obviously there's probably a good chance the reason why they just have him happily with Aphrodite and all the rest of it. And he clearly looks like a really happy chappy. He's clearly like, you know, he's a good guy. He's just good old Uncle Hephaestus. He don't mind. obviously, because, you know, getting into the nuances of his relationship with Aphrodite would be far too much for a kids' TV show.
It's not Disney.
It's just not very Disney, at least not Disney at that time. I mean, Disney today, they love to push the...
True.
But of course, the mouse has to make money somehow. So in all seriousness, I find the character design quite interesting. I mean, to me, the way I did read the embodiment of Hephaestus, the way he's described, I do imagine him as quite a big dude. Like, I read it is like he is quite muscular. And I would not be surprised if in some way he was at least equal to, if not in some ways, surpassing Ares and the other gods. Like, I mean, I think obviously... Ares' depiction there is also, again, Disney's very child-friendly way. You can't really just depict war in all its extremities. I think, obviously, I remember from the movie, Ares is obviously this very cantankerous sort of, like, you know, he just goes charging in sort of thing. But that's it. Like, he doesn't really embody that too much. But I think, for me, the kind of the larger size of Hephaestus, to me, as a disabled man, like, just kind of feels right, just because, like, if you've ever looked at a disabled person in general, they actually have quite more strength than people ever sort of realize, both on the inside and out. Like, you know, it is just a nature of who we are. We are very strong people. And so I like that. I think that's a nice touch. Mm-hmm. And I think showing him happy is nice. But I think you said, you know, they don't really touch on the disability aspect of it at all. Like, it just doesn't appear.
I don't think so. I could be wrong, but I don't think
Which in a sense is obviously a drawback. I think obviously taking that away, and that's not anything new to depictions of Hephaestus whenever he does appear in very brief kind of, it always seems to be, I've yet to see, obviously with the exception of what you've just told me, I've yet to see a depiction of Hephaestus in like TV or movies, at least, that ever kind of gives him more than maybe a few seconds on screen. Like, he never really seems to appear for very long, and there's never really a role for him. And I get that in a lot of the myths that he's in, he's never really that big of a player, but I would kind of like to see more of him in these sorts of ways. So going on to Lore Olympus, I find the decisions of Lore Olympus really interesting. And I think, as you said, that is mostly to its benefit, for sure. Like, the idea of, like, kind of taking away all these things that we often associate with him and humanizing him in this way, in a way that we can relate to him a little bit more, but also just fundamentally just see him for what he really is, which is just a crafter who is just very good at what he does. And he's just kind of on the periphery of these things, mostly by his own choice at this point. I mean, from the way, I mean, obviously I'm very new to Lore Olympus. So I only just really started, but already what I kind of see in it is that it's almost as if all of the stories that we know have already played out. So at this point, it is obviously a retelling of the whole Persephone story in some respect, but fundamentally the rest of it is already history to them. They're already just, the gods are just living their lives. So to me, from the sounds of it, Hephaestus has already done all this bullshit and is like, he's already done with it all. So he's like, I don't know whether that's ever something that they plan to touch on, maybe, whether they do intend to revisit his relationship with anger at any point, because I would like to see that. I do, like I said throughout this entire talk, I do think it's important, but that's not a criticism, because I do think there is a value in taking that away from the beginning and just being like, look, this is just who he is. This is what he does. I do find the use of blades quite interesting. And I think obviously that ties in with technology and the fact that he has created his own aids and stuff. Generally, truth be told, with disability, I prefer to see the embodiments reflected as is. But that doesn't mean I dislike the portrayal at all. Just to be clear, it's still a very beautifully drawn portrayal. And I like the design choices behind that. But I would also like to see a portrayal of Hephaestus that is just him with his clubbed foot. Like that would, to me, that would be important and it would be valuable, because it would do a lot, I think, to kind of dispel this kind of this sometimes societal view we have of any mal, even just a brief sign of physical difference, making all this kind of difference to the person, if that makes sense. Whereas obviously it's far more complex than that. I would just like to see that. But again, not saying I dislike it. It's still really, really good. And I like it. And he looks very, I like his kind of very quiet and contemplative expression. And I mean, you can still see like in just like, you can see that there is some fire in him in that sense. Like I like his eyes. His eyes have that kind of fiery glare to them, but he's not intimidating. Mm-hmm. The blue, I like the blue, because the blue kind of gives that more kind of chilled sort of tranquil, that peace sort of vibe. And I like that. And that's kind of a good juxtaposition, because I in that sense, again, I haven't got anywhere near it in the story yet. So this is just me going off just looking at the character design. But if we are going with this idea that, you know, he's just rejected the drama, this is maybe him just kind of saying, you know, this is what I want to be. This is the chill out sort of chill person I want to be. And he's taken the steps to make sure he is that. So in a way, he's taken the steps to be a better person than maybe he was in the past at some point, which, again, she may never plan to touch on it. And that's certainly fine if she chooses not to and chooses to take it in a different direction. That's her artistic license. And I mean, from what I've seen of it so far, it's great. But, you know, if she does decide to touch on it, that would be really cool as well, I think, to kind of look at this. And that's the other thing as well, is like this, as I said earlier, if there are any people listening who really want to do a modern kind of retelling of Hephaestus or kind of characterization of Hephaestus, I get asked this, I actually got asked this recently in a discussion about Hephaestus. It wasn't about him specifically, but it was about disabled characters. You know, can, I think the question was something along the lines of, can I have the disabled character be the villain, or at least, you know, be a bad person? Then it's like, of course you can. Anyone can be a good or a bad character or anywhere in between. The important thing is that the disability is, again, it's an embodiment. It's not the sole definitive reason for whether they are good or bad. And it's not something that defines them solely because of it or in spite of it. Don't frame it as that. It is just part of who they are. And if you really want to, I would say that if you are especially a non-disabled person doing this, talk to disabled people, read disabled people, you know, don't expect, you know, if you want to learn more, you need to be willing to get out there yourself and learn it and to take it in. There's so much great disability literature. I mean, even just a more modern recent book you could read, for instance, is Disability Visibility, which is a book edited by Alice Wong. It's a book that's very North American centric, but that's by its nature, because it's a book celebrating the 30th anniversary of the Americans with Disabilities Act. But it is a very good cross-section of various disabilities and other embodiments, trans, black, other minorities, so on and so forth, all these embodiments that kind of crossed North America society, who kind of write about their experiences with disability. And it just gives you a slice, just an understanding of just how multifaceted it is. But I would encourage you to go further than that and to find these authors and to follow them and to read them and to really understand them and you know, and to really kind of get a sense of what disability really means, which is that it's far more than just the kind of what you see on the surface or what you imagine even is going on underneath. If you're thinking about invisible disabilities like chronic pain or even mental health, it's far more multifaceted than that. And from the sounds of things, with the Lore Olympus depiction of Hephaestus, it has all the potential to really kind of go into those areas and to show how multifaceted it is. And I think most of all, for me, obviously I'm saying this as a disabled man, but I would want any depiction of Hephaestus to include it and to give it its due diligence in a way that sees it as part of what he is, not the sole definitive reason, or has nothing to do mm-hmm. with what he is. Like, you know, I want it to kind of mm-hmm. be part of who he is, but not the sole thing of what he is, if that makes sense. Yeah, mm-hmm.
absolutely. Yeah, I think that's a key piece, because it is who he is, but it doesn't have to be why, you know, why he is why he is or why he isn't. Mm-hmm. You know, yeah, it's just part of it. Mm-hmm. And interesting, I'm trying to remember what, I've completely forgotten kind of what role he plays in Lore Olympus. It was subtle, it was not big. So it'll be interesting to see what more she does. But I also think, you know, and not to turn this into Lore Olympus, but just one final statement on it, but what I like about her story, and specifically because of the Hades and Persephone aspect, is that it is more about rewriting the myths than retelling them, about completely removing the parts that don't work for the story that she wants to tell versus trying to work around them.
Fair enough.
For me, that's important because, like, I can't read versions of Hades and Persephone where they have retold the story to make the abduction okay versus what Rachel is doing is taking that all out, completely removing all the pieces of it, and just telling a story about these two characters. And that's what I like. And so when it comes to Hephaestus, I think it's more of like he's a separate, I mean, he's Hephaestus, but he is sort of separated from the things that we know of. I mean, not necessarily all of them, but separated from, I think, some of those pieces that would contribute there. I mean, I think separated from the Aphrodite pieces, which, you know, are sort of his most problematic aspects, you know, for whatever reasons, like related or unrelated. But yeah, it's just an interesting thing. Oh my gosh. I mean, obviously this was great because it's 2.5 hours. It's going to be probably officially my first two-part conversation episode. I mean, honestly, thank you so much.
Thank you for giving me this platform, for giving me the time just to talk about loads of different things. But I'm very excited. It's been absolutely lovely to talk to you. As soon as I heard that you were interested, I was like, yes, this is going to be great.
Thank you. Yeah.
This has been absolutely amazing.
Oh my gosh, thank you always for listening. It's such a thrill that I get to do this. I will say that every time. Apparently, I've got to get some new material, but it just keeps being true. I'm just so grateful for the people who will have these conversations with me, for you all for wanting to hear them, for the episodes that get sparked out of those conversations. It's really just so much fun. So I hope you love this one as much as I loved recording it. And next week, we're diving into some of the original reasons for this podcast, the shitty heroes, because I think we need a little bit of a refresh of that classic, wild, and problematic and super fun Greek mythology. Stay tuned. I am Liv and I love this shit.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. New year, new name, new energy, but
same old us.
And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. But that's not all. We will also have special guests to add their thoughts on the topics, as well as break down different political issues with local activists in their community. If you like to be informed and to expand your thoughts, listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Parents, ready to discover a new educational and interactive podcast for kids? Join Stories for Kids by Lingo Kids, where episodes are packed with fun activities. Right, Elliot?
Oh, yes! We learned how to recycle at the beach.
That was great fun. Callie, what do you say?
It was. And that time when we did the science experiment and Billy made Raisin's dance.
That is so cool, Billy.
He did. Not to mention when a certain Elliot took up swimming classes with Lisa.
That was me.
Bet you can't catch me.
I'm going to get you.
All this fun and more in our Stories for Kids. Lingo Kids Stories for Kids is now available on Storybutton, the kid-friendly device for screenless podcast listening. Listen to Stories for Kids on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.